A number of the slides, most of the slides I'm going to show today are from a talk that I have put together over the last year and a half. And so some of you will have seen the slides. I've actually reshuffled the deck because I was asked, first of all, to only talk for about half an hour so that there could be discussion. And I hope the discussion goes through the talk as opposed to wait till I'm done and then have the discussion. And so I've taken out a lot of stuff. But at the same time, my goal still is mostly to sort of talk to you about the observations that we're doing, and more importantly than the observations that we're doing, where I think these observations are sort of leading us for the next, certainly 3 to 5 years, in terms of what's going to be available and what people should already be thinking about in terms of data sets that will be available to try to constrain how star formation proceeds. So I'm mostly going to talk about the observations, but I can't help but bring in a few ideas about what I think might be going on. And please feel free to either shoot those down or use those to start discussion. The one other thing I want to point out is some people have been noting when I show this slide is it's starting to look a lot like a Formula One auto, with all of the different logos on it. And being a Canadian, I don't have any cigarette company logos because they're banned in the country. But the most important thing is that you'll see that there are all of these projects, in particular large-scale projects like the Complete Project, the C2D project that I've been working with, and then SCUBA, SCUBA 2 at the JCMT and ALMA in terms of the instrumentation that I've been looking at. And there's a lot more instrumentation, actually, that's going to give us some large constraints. But hidden in the middle is the most important information. Beyond my name are the people who've really been working with me. Helen Kirk, a graduate student at the University of Victoria who will graduate in just over a year. And she's been doing basically all of the work while I run around talking to people about what maybe we should be doing. James DeFrancesco, my colleague, and thankfully the guy who decided to take over the leadership of our group so I don't have to at the Hertzberg Institute. Jess Jorgensen, who was a postdoc with Phil Myers, who did a lot of stuff with C2D and who I've been working with, and of course the complete teams. So I'm going to start with the slide I usually end with, which is that the observational surveys are now providing significant statistical information. And so for all of you guys out there and girls out there who are trying to do simulations of star-forming regions, if you want to believe that your simulations are more than telling us about the physics, the type of physics that's at play, but you think these really are the simulations that tell us about star formation, then you have to get the clump mass and size distribution, the large-scale structure correct, the core mass and size distribution, which is the small-scale structure correct, the locations, the environmental locations, the clustering locations, frequencies of the various stages. We can get all of this information, I would say, now out of the observations. A little bit harder to do some of the stuff down here, the structure, filamentary ellipticity, directionality. That's tough because it's not clear to me that in the large area mappings we quite have the resolution to really do this yet. We're trying, but certainly ellipticity and directionality of the cores that we see in the nearby clouds is still hard. The kinematic information is coming along. It's a little bit harder to get, but we're really starting to get that. And, of course, there are a few people who are very brave and work really hard and are getting us the polarization information, and that's going to get easier with time as well. So the key point, even before I start the talk, is if you want to call yourself a theorist or a simulator that's actually looking at reality, you no longer have the IMF and the star formation efficiency to work with. You have all of this information. In fact, most of this has been known for years. But you really do have this information that you have to fit all at once if you really want to have a working model. So I'm going to run through. I wasn't going to start at the large scale, but given our discussion on Monday, I thought I would briefly just say that the largest scale inside the clouds, and I'm going to try to use the word clumping for sort of CO turbulent structure inside a cloud, and I'm going to try to keep to cores as being what we think is perhaps a phase transition to thermal objects. But the terminology, unfortunately, is a little bit confused, and as people know, we've got clumps, cores, condensations, kernels, clouds, and if Phil Myers had only named kernels with a C, they would all be M sub C, and we could just be completely confused. So the distribution of mass is shallow in molecular clouds, regardless of who does the structure analysis. Regardless of what method you use, you basically always end up with most of the mass on large scales and at low, in quotes, low column density. Okay? Meaning the lower column density is where all the mass resides. The mass has the mass resides on the largest scales. And
does that really mean that there's a very large amount of gas in densities like 100, or does that mean that you've got Most of the mass and high densities, they can smear it out.
Well, I guess that's still a bit of an open question, but it certainly seems that when we do things in two dimensions, it seems like there is a regularity on large scales, right? But that is a good question, is how much of this is a filling factor problem, okay? The other thing that's really important, of course, is that we total to the entire mass of the cloud. One of the things to remember when you use CO or you do extinction mapping is you're looking at everything in the cloud. In fact, when you do extinction mapping, you're maybe looking at things that aren't even in the molecular cloud but are in the transition zone or beyond. But you're basically summing to everything. The other things that we know with this, we know for a long time, we've known that we have relationships like the non-thermal size versus mass relation, the Larson's law, which tells us that we need some type of non-thermal support to hold this up if this thing is indeed being held up for any length of time at all. So on the large scales, they dominate within the molecular cloud.
So top relation angles of minus 1/2, that's in the CO, but CO
that's right.
Frees out. So,
that's right, but yeah. I'll talk. Doesn't matter at all because the submillimeter stuff, as I will show, is only looking at 1% of the mass of the cloud. A few percent of the mass of the cloud. The dense stuff is nothing. It's just a tracer. In fact, you know that or you hope that already because star formation is just a tracer of the mass of the cloud. So it doesn't hurt us that we're losing those guys. The CO is there in the broad stuff. That's not the reason why we get this relation.
Could that relation have something to do with optical depth effects?
Well, this relation may have something to do with optical depth effects, but when we look at this with through extinction mapping, no, because the extinction mapping, it's optically thin, unless you really believe you're looking at tiny, tiny little bullets that are very dense, right? So, no, I don't think that's the case. And that was what I was going to show you, was from the work that I've been doing with, and this, of course, actually goes back, the people who are making the maps are Joao Alves and is it Marco Lombardi? Who use this technique called NICER to do extinction mapping using two mass in particular. And the nice thing there is by going to the two mass colors, you're able to now look to extinctions of sort of 1 to 20 or so, AVs of 1 to 20, which means you really can probe through molecular clouds, whereas in the optical it's hard to get into the dense zones. And here's a map that they've made of Ophiuchus, and here's a map that they made of Perseus. And while you do see some regions in these maps that have high extinction, the extinction only in here gets up to something like maybe 10, the highest AV they get. This is on 5 arc minutes or few arc minute length scales because they're smoothing over. But the extinction only gets up to something like 10 AV here, and here it gets up to about 30. But this is a tiny fraction of the mass of the entire region. That's where the argument's coming from.
Okay. So that N going as M to 1 F. First of all, N is the column density, or
no? That was N was the number there, the number of objects.
DNDM, is that what it is? I mean,
DNDlogN.
Yeah.
DNDlogN.
Yeah. It's the distribution such that all the mass ends up in the high end, and as we see, when you go to stars for the saltpeter, by that same thing, saltpeter would be minus 1.5 instead of
so
minus
when you
0.5.
Do this for say these two maps, like how large is your N that you actually use?
How large is which?
Your clump finding.
Oh yeah, so we haven't actually gone. I haven't bothered to go in and do the clump finding stuff on this because it's 2D, not 3D. And now because I'm also looking at all of the mass, when I do this, I've got real problems with smearing. And so the people who do the clump finding and give you the numbers of objects you get at a level of mass do that in the CO where they can try to separate out the objects, right? And I forget how many they would get in something like this, but you can sort of get an idea because you're going to get down to, you know, something like a dozen or so on their smallest scale, which would be something like 100 solar masses here.
Is that blobby structure in Perseus all over the place have to be real? Or is that
no, some of that, I think that's telling you about how well they can do AV at low AV.
But you did say that, I mean, when I was asking that question about N to the minus 1, you did say that the more massive ones have less column, didn't you say that?
Yeah. The more massive ones have less
column. I thought you said
that. Well, no, what I said is that less of the mass is... So there's two ways to try to do these things, right? And if you... There's clearly the cloud has low AV and high AV. And the method that I use, I don't do a numbering game of this color, this clump, this clump, this clump, this clump. What we've been doing is just asking how much mass is there at various AV. Okay, because that I can take right out of the column density map. I can just look at the column density map and I can say how much mass is there at this column density, how much mass is there at this column density. And that's what these plots are just to show you. This is only the region we looked at.
So the total mass, is that from the dust or the molecules?
This is from the, so Bear with me. This is from the molecules using the dust as the tracer. Okay? Right? Using the extinction as the tracer.
You trace everything.
No, the
H1 and
yes. No, no, that's right. There could also be H1 at some of the low AV stuff. That's right. There could be low...
Right, so
that's
how
right.
Do the molecules get into the mass estimate?
The molecules get into the mass estimate by taking the extinction along the line of sight and taking a constant conversion for dust to gas.
I'm sorry. My question was, if I observe Ophiuchus in molecular gas, I will also get a mass estimate. I just want to know
that's right.
How the extinction mass estimate compares with...
Oh, okay. So we did that in both the Ophiuchus and the Perseus papers, and to within factors of two, we're fine. Okay, when you go and you look at what people say they get for mass in the same amount of volume, we get to within a factor of two what the CO people were saying that they would get.
The sizes.
In roughly the same size. So what all we do is we go to the CO maps and we say, okay, within this volume or within this distance length, what are they getting for the mass of the region? And you can see in Ophiuchus, we're not looking at all of Ophiuchus. We're still really constrained down in the center of it. So we're only looking at a few thousand solar masses. But you can see that, point that out though, we are looking at is we're looking at this region in here, which is already biased to the high extinctions. And yet when you go in and you ask about it, you find that the mean AV is below 7. Mean AV is about 4 there, even though it does get up to very high AVs. Okay? And the same thing in Perseus. The point is that most of the mass that you're looking at is at low AV. You are right. There is the molecular hydrogen, atomic hydrogen, and as we start to say where means are down at around 1 or 2, we do actually have to worry about how much of this would be atomic.
It's normal that the numbers are the same because the CO2 reach factor is ascribed to fit with the total extinction.
Well, no, that's right. People have done it from the past, but we've gone and, yes, that's right. That's where the people have put all of it in the first place. That's where the conversion factor between dust and, exactly. No, so you expect it to be the same.
So that's good.
Yes, absolutely. I would have been concerned if we got something else and we would have had to think about what was actually causing us the problem. That's right. So the key point in all of this, though, is that the large scales dominate. Okay? So if we go and we look at the core structure, and when I talk about the core structure, I'm referring with my own work to the stuff we've done at the JCMT with SCUBA, where we basically only pick up the dense, small-scale structure. Basically, that's twofold. One is a sensitivity issue in order to pick material up, and the other is the fact that we have to chop the instrument because of the sky, so we actually chop out all large-scale structure. So we're only able to pick up the small-scale structure. Okay? And so when we do that, what we find is we get a very different, and I'll show you some pictures in a second, but we get a very different set of pieces of information. One of those is that the number of objects, and here we do start counting objects, and we can do it because they are separated enough, it's still a problem, but they're separated enough that even in 2D I can pick them up without needing to use the velocity information. When we do this, we get maybe of order 100 objects in each of the maps, so to give you an idea of the numbers we're getting, it's not large. But we get a mass distribution which is much steeper than that for the clouds. In fact, it looks very similar to an IMF, and some people would like to say it is the IMF. I'm not convinced yet, but we will see. It's independent of structure analysis. Everybody who plays this game basically gets this for the small-scale stuff. And the most important thing, to get to Ralph's comment and the like, is that it totals to a very small fraction of the mass of the cloud. We're not talking about all of the mass here. We're talking a few percent of the mass of the cloud. This stuff is the stuff that's sort of fallen out. Okay? If we go through, and I'll try to give you some arguments for this both in this section where I'm just going to do it based on the sizes of objects, but also when we talk about the kinematics, there's basically a thermal size in this that we're picking up here, a Jeans length that we're picking up. These guys do not need to have a lot of non-thermal motion in them in order to hold them up. They're small, they are Jeans mass type objects living in the pressured regime of the molecular cloud. At least if you think of them that way, you can fit them. So Bonner-Ebert spheres will fit them, whether they are Bonner-Ebert spheres or not. Bonner-Ebert spheres give you the right scalings for all of your relations. And they're found in very particular parts within the cloud.
But wait a second, that assumes that there is an anticorrelation of mass and density, which is incorrect. It's not what you find.
What I'm saying is that if all I'm saying by the Bonner-Ebert sphere type of calculation, I'm saying is if I take what I feel that I need to have as a pressure inside the cloud, given how much mass there is and everything else, I just come up with a number, okay? Whether you give that to me through RAM pressure or whatever, there's some type of pressure that I feel I need to have in a sort of typical place inside the cloud. All I'm saying is that if I use that number and I use the properties of the cores that we find, I can explain these cores as being just thermal objects.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's a very rough statement, because if it were close to, if it were not a rough statement, the bigger objects should be the lower density ones, but I don't think that's what you find.
Well, let me show you in a second. Let me.
Juice mass, that's what I'm saying.
What's that? Well, let me show you as I go.
Critical. You're not saying that they're all critical Bonnery-Ebert spheres.
No, I'm not saying they're all critical Bonnery-Ebert spheres at all. In fact, I think, but I'll get to that. There's a plot that I'll get to, because there's a big discussion in the community, particularly between Philippe André, Derek Ward-Thompson, and myself, about how to interpret some of this. And I wanted to leave that, actually, as an open question. So.
Yeah, but it's written on your viewpoint.
Which, the critical, but I say that these are pressure confined. The largest objects would be gravitationally unstable in this type of an idea, right? There will be a gravitational instability, and you will see some of these things. Well, I'll show you it. Give me a few seconds, and I'll show you the plot, okay?
So is that a condensation problem? I mean, is Xi larger than 14 in most of the objects you are fitting, the Bonnery-Ebert spheres?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The density difference between the center and the...
No, the density difference between the center and the edge of most of the objects I'm seeing does not appear to be a problem. I'll show you. I'll comment a bit more about that in a bit, although we have trouble getting that because we really don't have the resolution we should have to really try to get that number properly. We have a resolution that is, well, if I go straight to the next view graph, we have a resolution which is something like about 3,000 AU, which is getting us in the nearby clouds, which is getting us to maybe half a gene's length or so, but it's not getting us really much better than that to really be able to see what's going on. Okay? So let me point out, the one comment I wanted to make from the previous view graph was just to make the statement that this material is very different than the bulk properties of the cloud. When we'd first done the mapping, and it was actually Frederick Mott and Philippe André who went and looked at Ophiuchus first, but when we were first doing the mappings, you had visions like this, and these were the plots that everyone was showing, and you get the idea that these cores just are everywhere. But of course, this is a very specialized, very small part. This isn't even a square degree. It's a small fraction of a square degree inside Ophiuchus. So we decided to go out and map 4 square degrees of Ophiuchus. And based on the number of objects, about 30 or 40 objects we'd found here, we said, we expect to find hundreds, maybe thousands of new sources. They gave us about a week of observing to do this, and we found 2. These 2 guys out here. Those are the only new sources. This thing is just this down here. There's nothing in this map. It's a bit noisier because we had a map a little bit quicker and everything, but there's nothing in this map. And what I want to remind you is if you go and look at the column density map, this is where all the mass of the cloud is. It's not where all the interesting mass. The interesting mass is the stuff that's in the dense region at the center. But this is where the mass of the cloud is.
And that's all at low extinction.
It's at low extinction.
And what is the extinction?
Here, it's above about 15. And out here, it's below 15, getting down to, the mean extinction in this whole region is 4. This is the region that I was giving you the numbers for before.
So that answers the question I started off with. There is material out there. It's not just a filling factor issue. There's low density material.
It certainly isn't getting up to the densities where we would pick it up with scuba. It's not getting up to enough. So you could still imagine putting lots of little guys out there and having a filling factor and us not being able to see it, but you have to start playing that game. That's right. That's right.
You still have a good constraint of the extinction really high up, so you can actually set constraints on the density profile if you think of it as a round cloud.
If you wanted to think of it as a sphere or something like that, you could try that game. Chris has done better jobs of that. We tried it the other way around because we tried to guess what the pressure would be as a function of position, because I was trying to make sure that I wasn't losing objects just because the pressure was going down and they were expanding too much for me to see them. So we tried it the other way around, but I wouldn't want to try to make Perseus or Ophiuchus into a sphere, and well, because in particular,
I'm just saying, if you have a very large dynamic range,
yeah.
Here, so if I one of R squared versus one of R,
I don't actually. It's not that large a dynamic range. I get up to about an AV of 15 here, and I get down to an AV of 2. That's not really a large dynamic range. I have a large Planck scale. Yeah. Yeah, that would actually be a useful number. Would actually be to go in and just try to figure out what a length scale would be. That's right. No, we haven't done that. So, and just to let you know, we did this with about a week's worth of work. This took probably a few hours' work because we basically just stole this from the JCMT archive, which points out how useful it is when people get data, that that data actually get put somewhere so that if you don't actually publish within a certain length of time, everybody else gets access to it.
I want to go back to your response to Tom. So, as you know, the pressure goes like the square of the surface sensor. So if you go down, if there were clumps, at 15 and I go down to 2, then that 7, that'll be the pressure would be 15.
I thought it, wait, I have to remind myself. I thought it only went as the, within a given cloud, I thought it only went as the column density, because I thought it went as the mean times the column density that you're at.
Well, I'm talking about things that are gravitational bound. So I'm getting close to critical. So anyway, my question is, as you can see these cores down there, what is the dynamic range of your ability to detect cores?
Yeah. Okay. So let me just see if I put the plot on. I don't remember if I left it in here. I was going to leave it in for you in case, because I thought you might ask a question like this. But did I actually leave it on here? Yes. Here's the, no, that's not the one, it's this one. Come on, how do I get to the one I want? There we go. This is the plot I think you want. This is the information on the total flux in a core that we find when we do a clump find analysis, the peak flux that we see in the core, and the size of the core that we would get. Okay, so those are the numbers that you can get out of trying to do a fit. And these are putting them on as a function of what the AV is through the cloud due to the extinction. Okay? And what I've done here, the different lines on this are assuming that the pressure in the mean sort of pressure in the molecular cloud is varying with AV according to the rule that was in your paper. Okay? And what I see is that I suddenly go from having guys that I can see to not having them. It's not like I've got a resolution problem, the sensitivity problem. They just disappear. Okay, right at a very, and again, what you have to remember is this is a tiny fraction of the area that I'm looking at. This is where all the area is. So if I had a problem that I just had random things or accidental things, this is where I would expect to be finding them because this is where all the area in the cloud
is. Where's your sensitivity limit?
Where's my sensitivity limit? It's down here, right?
Oh, okay, that's.
Well, what I showed you, next graph looks
right?
Like it was similar to what I was thinking. It looks like your dashed line is your sensitivity limit, and in fact, and the solid line, I assume, is some upper limit, and so it disappears in an AV of 5. You wouldn't see anything.
No, but the point is, I see these guys all lying around the line, and then nothing has changed from one side of this green line to the other. They've just disappeared. And I don't think, and there's more area here than there is here. So I would have said I have.
It appears, I agree, the ones that are high F0 disappear, but there.
There is stuff down here. There's fluff in here. But if this, yes. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I missed. What's the green line?
The green line is just a line that I've put to guide your eye as to where it looks like in AV we suddenly no longer have sources. So I would have said that if you just had the cloud and if there was no problem, if you could just make cores anywhere and you made them wherever you made them sort of given the pressure in the environment, I would have said that we shouldn't see anything, nothing is changing across this line. Yes, down here there's a real change because I have to have them have high fluxes or I won't. They won't exist. Down here, there's a bit of something, but in fact, nothing has happened here, so I would have said I should see things all the way in.
So what's the solid line in that rule?
Which solid line? This solid line?
Yeah, what
this solid line is, I believe, following a critical Bonner-Ebert sphere. So
okay,
that's the peak flux of a critical Bonner-Ebert sphere as I change the pressure of the environment in which I'm in. And I'm just saying that the peak flux didn't change, the total flux didn't change, and so there's no reason why they should stop existing. There's no reason why they should stop existing on one side of the line from the other.
The ones that you're talking about are the supercritical. That is, those are unstable. All the ones above that line are unstable.
They may very well be unstable. Those are probably the ones that have actually started to form stars. But I don't see anything like that on this side of the line.
You still have Bonner-Ebert spheres on the left.
Oh, I get, no, there are things. And as you go to faint objects, we can't even really tell you what's going on. We don't have the sensitivities to see. You're absolutely right. It would be very nice to know, and it'd be nice to know how much I have to worry about whether I pick these guys up correctly. Absolutely. What I'm trying to do is say that the main thing I was trying to say is that I see interesting creatures over here, and I don't see the interesting creatures on this side of the line.
You're saying it's a threshold for star formation.
That's right. That's right. Which nobody.
Right, but not a threshold for core formation.
Well, we don't know. I certainly don't see. Look at this. I don't see bright objects over here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do see them over here, and I don't see them over here. So I'm not sure you're forming any cores at all over here.
What's that? You should have a course. In the second, there are a lot of cores. It's just they're none that are.
This is the peak flux, right? So I see lots of little things where I have a peak flux that's high enough, right?
If I understand it, you don't see any that are supercritical that are gravitationally unstable. You see a bunch of gravitationally stable things.
I would say that they don't have any mass in them, because that's what I can see from here, right? This is total flux. This is just peak flux. So they don't have any mass in them. So I'm not forming anything with any real mass.
If my understanding of your graph is that if I go to a critical binary Ebert sphere, then the combination of those two figures shows that you shouldn't. They become invisible. A critical binary Ebert sphere becomes invisible. That's what you're saying.
I'm trying to remember which one's the critical. As I look at this, this must be the critical line here. So this one here must just be, which fit am I going through here? Because this is the critical. The dashed dotted line is the critical, which I didn't put in the flux. But the point is that there is structure out here, but remember there's also a huge amount of area out there. And so the point is that something does seem to be changing. But you're right. When we do one of the problems that we had in doing this, which is frustrating, is that in order to map this much area, we had to go quickly. So this plot was to tell me that I had the sensitivity to see lots of objects, and that sensitivity didn't change across here. But in order to really understand what I'm seeing down at the small scale, we need the mapping power, and Scuba 2 will give it to us. And I'll show you on a plot just how much better we'll get when Scuba 2 comes along.
Do these cores have a fairly sharp boundary?
Well, that's part of the question. That's part of what actually makes it difficult to do, is it's not really clear how to get the edges of these guys, right?
And just blend off into the background?
The sensitivity becomes a problem, right? We can pick up the peak. The peak is maybe 5 times above the noise, but then to get the edge, it becomes really difficult. We don't have a huge resolution, right? Spatial resolution. We're sort of okay, but not greatly okay. So that is a huge game that we've got to play. And I think it's going to be bigger when we use Scuba 2. It's clear. It's already clear from what we know that these objects are going to start melding into a background, and how to separate them is a game that you haven't even decided what to do.
So in the low AV area, all these dots, are they how far from your noise are they?
They were.
Can you tell that? Okay, no. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, can you with a lot of significance say that there is structure and it's not consistent with being uniform?
Good question. We went in and we used a clump finding algorithm and we pull out those objects. Those are not the objects. I believe most of those objects will prove to be real sources when we look, but we may not be getting their sizes right. We may not be getting their total fluxes right and the like. But if we're getting their total fluxes wrong, it's because they may be bigger. And they may be bigger because we may not be following them far enough. That sort of connects to Dave's question. In fact, that's one of the things that I'm convinced. When people have looked with BoloCam and that, and they've gone deeper so far, when they start to get to fainter objects, peak flux objects, what they find is they start to become quite broad. And those are the objects where, if you ask what do you need to make them faint but broad, you know, not too peak but broad, they need to have non-thermal motions in them. And so it's not clear to me that those peaks that we're seeing aren't actually in that regime. But that's where we're going to need the better sensitivity. But it's coming. Okay? So the point is we have two sets of maps, but you've hit on where the issues are in the observations that have come. Okay? We have two sets of maps. There are objects that we can clearly see, and the objects that we clearly see stop. And they stop before I would have believed that they should have stopped, just because for some reason we should be allowed to make stars in one side and not allowed to make stars on the other side. Okay? There seems to be, there's like a physical transition that seems to have occurred, and I don't know why that's happening.
It couldn't be just confusion, because you had the high extinction, you know, even if they all were the same size. It just looks from this map, they just become blended.
No, this map doesn't. Look at this map. Don't look at this map. It's not nearly as bad as this. I've tried to compress it so that I can show you just how big a map we've made, right? This is the resolution of this map. It's just I'm not very good at making pretty pictures. And that's the same thing with this.
And so for the high ones, you're convinced that
the high ones, I'm convinced. There may be some. Yeah, we have problems with blending in here occasionally, but the problem is not huge. And you can go in and you see really strong peaks. And you can pick those things out and they separate out. So I don't think that's the problem at all. So the other comment I made is that they do live in very I've already sort of said, they live at high AV, they live in specialized zones. If you look at an extinction map and then you look at the SCUBA map, and in this case the black in both of these is showing you the dense structure, the bright structure, they're both negatives. And what you see is, you know, and so I'm enough of an observer now, and since I came down here pretending to be an observer, I should be able to tell you IC348, B1, NGC 1333. I'm very proud of the fact that I actually know the names of a few regions. So you can see that you get that, and one other way to plot it is to do a cumulative mass plot, where what you do is, for the cloud as a whole, this is for Perseus, so the cloud as a whole that we had, we look at how much of the mass is above, let's say, how much of the mass is at AV greater than a certain value, and you see that until you get down to an AV of 2 or 3, you've got only 50% of the mass or so. If you look at the region that we were looking at in the submillimeter, which was, again, only a specialized region in the cloud, you know, the 50% line may be in about an AV of 4 or 5, but if you ask where is all the submillimeter mass, basically flux, all of the millimeter flux is at high AV. This is in Perseus, so it's a similar thing to what I was showing you for Ophiuchus. The submillimeter structure lies in the high AV zones. I miss large-scale submillimeter. That's right, but the submillimeter structure I'm talking about, that's right, is the small-scale condensed stuff. If you wanted to ask what you think the density is in it, it's typically densities of 10 to the 5th to almost up to 10 to the 6th. So we're looking only at the densest stuff when we do that. That's right. There's going to be undoubtedly, in fact, if I really could do it, I should see the whole cloud. And so there is another component, but this is the small-scale structure that I can pick up. That's right. So I'll skip this plot. It just says exactly the same thing.
These on your really bright clumps, can you actually see what the density distribution in the clump is?
We can do a bit, but the biggest problem is that we don't have enough spatial resolution. Our spatial resolution is only maybe, you know, a third to a half of the genes length. And for even for Bonner Ebert sphere or anything else, I don't get that many genes lengths across, so it becomes very hard to do. Philippe has tried it by going much deeper, and people are trying to do it with some of the extinction work. But we need better resolution to really be able to get that. And then we're going to see that we do run into this problem. As I said, it's going to go into, when we start to get the sensitivity, we're going to see what these things are living in, because they're not just sitting there on their own. They're living in an environment. That's right.
So did you compare this with ammonia cores observation? Because I thought those densities were typically like 10 to the 4.
Right. But most of those ammonia cores that Phil was looking at weren't deep inside complex star-forming regions like this. And so that is one of the differences. And we talked about that in one of our papers in terms of a hierarchy. It looks like those ammonia cores have, as I'll show in a minute, have a smaller association of them actually with stars inside them. We're finding about 50% of our cores end up having stars.
I thought had 50%.
I thought in general it was a smaller number than that from his 10 to the 4. Because we were looking at the numbers saying that we were getting that the 10 to the 5th gas lived shorter lives before it became stars. I thought he was more like 10% to 30%, but we'd have to look that up.
My recollection was when IRAS, I thought they did an IRAS survey of the cores, and then that was one of the interesting things, that about 50%
right.
of the cores had stars.
Right. Well, we'd have to take a look at that. I'd have to take a look at the what's going on there, because we were putting a ratio. In some cases, ammonia cores would be around some of these things. That's right. There's a size scale going on. Yeah. So let me just give you the numbers here for this first bit. Is that the cores are about 2% of the mass of the cloud. If these numbers are all modulo factors of 2 or 3, because you know it's all done from doing conversions between how much brightness or how much extinction I have and converting that to total gas. They represent something like 10 to 20% of the mass of the high extinction zones that they're living in. So they aren't the whole reason for this high extinction zone. They're living in it. And they live primarily high AV. They seem to have a stellar IMF-like distribution, which, of course, is very similar to what Charlie Lotta and Liz Lotta found for the embedded stellar clusters. So it does look like, you know, just looking at these beasts, they walk like a duck, quack like a duck, they might be related to ducks.
Well,
right?
One of the other properties of the ducks is they actually have a turnover. Do you see that?
You mean at low mass?
At low mass.
And I would say that, again, Philippe, others have looked at it. We've got it. We see the turnover. I don't trust the turnover yet. And that's actually a good reason to put up the next plot. So here's the plot that's caused a lot of controversy in the community. And if I could go back and do this plot again myself, the one thing I would do is I would have made sure that I used observers' units and not theorists' units, because we do know what we got. This is really a plot on this axis of flux. This is the brightness of the object, the total brightness of the object that I'm looking at. This is the size scale that I get out for the object. And just look at the dots on the plot. So this is basically just showing you, and I think this is Ophiuchus, but I couldn't tell you. Yeah, this is Ophiuchus. This is showing you where we got, when we did a clump finding type analysis, all of our objects, where they would lie. The two lines to remember are, there's a resolution. I can't see anything smaller than this because that's my beam size. And I can't see anything fainter than this because it's my sensitivity. And the reason it goes up is it's a surface density sensitivity. So if I've got a big object, it has to have more mass, it has to have more flux in it for me to see, because if I'm spreading that flux out over a large area, I'm going to lose it. I lose low brightness surface density objects. So that's the plot. Now, when I did this, went in and said, what if these things were Bonn-Rebert spheres? I don't know that they are. I'm just saying, what if they were? And what if I take the mean pressure inside the molecular cloud, which is P over Ks of getting upwards of 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 7th, is what I would get for the pressure. And I was getting that both by taking line widths in the CO, and converting that to what I would attempt effective temperature, or just taking the mass and the radius and taking an assumption. Either of those give you the same numbers. 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 is the pressure inside the cloud. And so if you then say, this is just a range of 10, I think it's going from 3 10 to the 6 to 3 10 to the 7, and it's just saying, okay, if my cores are 15 degrees Kelvin or so, what would they look like if they were just pressure-confined Bonn-Rebert spheres all the way up to collapsed? If that were the case, that's what they would look like, and everything above this red line or so would be collapsing, according to Bonn-Rebert and, you know. So this is very straightforward. You can do this. Now, Philippe and a lot of others have this line can move around a little based on what you think your conversion factors are and the like between flux and mass, and they basically move it down a bit. And they look at this, and they are more drawn to the fact that all of these objects seem to lie close to the critical line. And so if you talk to them, they would argue that these objects are lying on the critical line, and then that's where everything lies. My gut feeling is that we've got to see the objects that fall down into this regime that haven't yet got enough mass to collapse. But it's really a question of, how do I assemble this material in the first place?
Could you comment more on this discrepancy in the mass estimates?
It has to do with a few things. One of those is what temperature you assume the cores to be, because we really don't know the temperatures. I use more 15, 20 Kelvin. They use more 10, 15 Kelvin. So if they're colder, then there's more mass per unit flux. You can change your value of kappa by a factor of 2 or 3, and nobody can really tell you one way or the other which is right. So this is a problem. The other thing I do is I use a radius, which is an extent, when I make...
I think I would have thought with your extinction, you have extinction and emission.
I don't have extinction on this scale. The extinction maps are on arc-minute scales. These things are on 15 arc-second scales. They're only a small fraction of the mass that I see in the extinction map, so I can't do that yet. People have tried, but that's where it's complicated. Yeah?
The black curve, they should... On the black curve, since you are in pressure equilibrium, you should have... the mass should grow as the cube of...
That's right. This is mass going as R cubed.
Okay. And the red curve is R squared.
The red curve is R, right? Mass goes as R, if I remember correctly.
I thought that you would...
mass goes as R.
The critical points are on an R squared.
No, a critical point, if the temperature inside is held constant, then it's M goes as R for Bonn-Rebert critical. Yeah. If the temperature is constant, M goes as R. We'll have to look it up, but if the temperature is constant,
yeah,
mass
right.
goes as R.
Yeah, M over R
is constant.
The thermal loss.
Yeah. The R squared is this line here, which is my sensitivity limit. So I have all three, R cubed, R squared, and R.
But you have the gravitational branch, which goes as R, and the pressure equilibrium branch, which goes as R. R cube, and the critical points are on the locus, which goes R squared.
No, for a constant temperature object, these are constant temperatures. These are constant temperature objects.
Okay.
That's why.
Okay.
Yeah. Varying the pressure.
Yeah.
And so anyways, you could live in this type of a thing.
One thing though, just a quick question.
Yeah.
I thought you said a lot of these cores had stars inside them, or did I?
There are a fraction of them. I'll get to that in a minute. That's the next section of the talk. But yes, there are ones. All of the ones with stuff inside them lie right up here, right near that line or above, or almost all of them. I will get back to that.
I thought you said some high fraction.
Yeah, 50%. Well, yeah, no. That's right. So this is that's what I mean by this is a mug's game in how you do some of this stuff. I'll get back to that though. Okay. So this was the first way we did the data, and one can play it a little bit more. I wanted to point out two things. This, by the way, this yellow line is sort of where you expect sort of an AV of a few, which is the typical AV in that molecular cloud. Okay? So if we could get down here, we'd be starting to pick up structure in the cloud. And more importantly, this is also basically the sensitivity line we're going to get down to with SCUBA 2 when we do something like 100 square degrees of Gould's belt. And so we will really be able to hopefully understand, we'll have a lot further range here, so we'll be able to see whether there is a zone that these objects are lying in. And this also lets me get back to the comment about whether I believe the turnover that people are seeing. If there is a turnover, if the turnover is real, it could be real, but the big problem I have is that in most of these arguments, they say that they're complete down to that limit. And my belief is, because there's a sensitivity limit here, which is a surface density limit, they may not be as complete as they think they are at the bottom end, because they wouldn't have seen these objects if they were living in a slightly different part of the cloud. So I'm not convinced that that turnover is real yet. And the fact that it moves, if I'm using SCUBA, the fact that it gets larger as I move to clouds further away, like Orion and the like, leads me to believe that it really is a resolution effect. Yeah,
but, well, so that's certainly valid for the ones that are done in dust continuum emission, but what about the ones that have been done in the nicer maps, where the sensitivity limit is going to be quite different?
Yeah, so you're talking about the stuff that was done in the Pike Nebula, basically, by Joao Alves and that. He should have a slightly better time at it. I have a problem with trying to understand what his objects are, though, because the size scales that he has for things are already different. But yes, that he might have a better luck, but you still want to do a plot like this to see whether or not it was dependent on where he's looking.
Where are the collapsing objects?
The collapsing objects would be the ones that are up here, right?
There's so few.
Well, we'll get back to that in a second, okay? That was Dave's point as well.
I'm so confused, actually, so you have...
Yeah.
Sort of one gene's mass in a way now is at 1,000 AU or so. It's made up of many, many clumps. Like all the dots you have, they're all a tenth of the Bonnet-Abrams mass.
Right, sort of. Most of the objects, if I were to believe this plot initially, most of the objects that I have are pressure confined. They're not self-gravitating. That's right. If you're to believe that plot at first blush, that's what it would say. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But if you were to believe it at first blush, that's what it would say. Okay. So, the embedded protostellar stage. We can get at the embedded protostars now because of Spitzer. And thankfully, both starting with C to D and then moving beyond C to D, there's a C to D plus plus or whatever it's being called, and which is looking at all the rest of Gould's belt. So we should have maps which we can pull out the protostars for all of the regions that will be done with both the SCUBA 2 Gould Belt survey and hopefully the Herschel Gould Belt survey, which is also going to take place. And so you can go in, and this becomes a very simple thing. All you have to do is go in and say, is there a 24 micron or so source living in the center of one of my SCUBA cores? And so you can immediately determine whether or not there's a protostar associated with each of these things. And the answer is about of order 50% of the objects actually have a protostar inside them. So if all of these things collapse, it gives you an idea of how long these objects have before they collapse. And it has to be of order the time scale that they live in the class zero phase. Okay? At this density. Doesn't tell me about the fluffier things, if there are fluffier things that have to get here.
But the objects. Embedded sources are not class one sources.
The embedded sources are almost definitely, for almost all of them are definitely class zero type sources, because the envelope masses we're talking about here are typically, you know, a third or so of a solar mass, if not a solar mass, right? So the envelopes around them are dense. We actually tried in the paper to keep away from class zero, class one, class two, because the observational definitions are complicated compared to this. But
it depends on the lifetime. My memory is that half of the ammonia cores have embedded sources, and then they made the same conclusion that they're short lived, but they were comparing with class one lifetime, so they got timescales I think of several hundred thousand years.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, so here we would say we were comparing to the class. So maybe that's where the big difference is. Here we're saying we're looking at dense gas close in, and so we were assuming that these guys were the deeply embedded sources. In that sense, that's right. One of the things that was interesting is that Spitzer's resolution at about 24 microns on that is about 5 arc seconds. And within that 5 arc seconds, when we would look at a core, we hardly ever saw more than one source inside the core. So at the 5 arc second resolution, which is about 1,000 AU, we don't see much fragmentation, much evidence for some type of fragmentation forming multiple objects inside a given core. That doesn't mean you don't have binaries. It just doesn't mean you don't have wide binaries inside a given core. The concentration, or how peaked the core looked, which sort of gets back to what you were saying, how it turns out to be a proxy for whether or not they have a deeply embedded, whether they have an object inside them or not. It's a little bit dangerous. I originally liked to use that as the relating it to the Jeans mass and Bonner-Ebert, because the more peaked you are, the more centrally concentrated you are, the more likely you are to be unstable. The other, unfortunately, you can also turn it the other way and say, I've got a source inside there. That source is heating up the center a little bit, and therefore it looks a bit more peaked than it would be otherwise. So we have to be a little bit careful about how we do that.
Fragmentation, because if Jack Welch were here, he makes radio line observations, and he says that when he's using BIM and he's looking at high resolution, he always finds things breaking up. And I think that is on the scale you're talking about.
On the few arc second scales? But does he see sources, or does he see breakup of the structure? This is saying, when I'm talking about 5 arc seconds here is a 24 micron source, so I've got a star. I don't have a 24 micron source if I don't have a star. So I'm saying that there may be breaking up. There may be, undoubtedly, these things are not just monolithic objects, right?
Yeah, but I think he finds evidence for binary.
He sees structure. But what we're saying is at 5 arc seconds, we don't see multiple objects. That's right. So
it could be a dynamic range problem also, or not. That is, if I had it.
No. Not really, no. With Spitzer, that didn't seem to be the problem. The notion of whether, with 24 microns, we got lots of flux. So it's not like we're not seeing sources because they're faint. At least that's what they tell me. Okay? So the important thing to take away message is that the dense cores seem to be highly correlated with star formation. Okay? And if I just want to show you, I'll show you, I think, basically two plots. And this is, what we did is, if you take each core and ask where is the closest protostar to that core, okay, actually closest star that they found in the infrared with Spitzer in IRAC or MIPS. And if you just ask where the closest one is to each of sort of the 100 cores we have, this is a scatter diagram of where the closest 24 micron, well, not necessarily 24 micron, where the closest Spitzer source lies to the core. This is what you would get if you took those same cores and just randomly located them on the map. This is just one way of saying that we sort of expect to have randomly one background galaxy, in this case, one background galaxy that would lie inside our core, inside one of our cores, one of our 100 cores. But what we really see is a real peak up, and these red guys are the red sources in the Spitzer catalog, which doesn't surprise you, because if you've got something deeply embedded, it's going to look red. And they lie right down smack dab in the middle of our cores. And then this stuff is basically telling you that cores are gregarious beasts, and they like to live with stars that are already forming, the other protostars. So, that doesn't surprise you, these things born in clusters.
On your last paper, you said something about cores forming efficiently, but quick and efficient.
Oh, yeah, I don't really discuss much of that here.
What do you mean by efficient? Because I thought that they only make up a couple percent of the cloud.
Yeah, what we were trying to do is we were looking at, and I'd have to go back and look at the paper again. I didn't put the plot in here. But the efficiency there was how much of the mass is going from the cores. The cores that we see, that mass is turning into stars. And that's what I mean by efficiently. What I mean is, compared to people, some of the turbulent calculations early were saying there was all this chaff. And this chaff was there, and I was picking up, there was a wonderful paper called Turbulent Cores in Hydrostatic Disguise, for example, that were claiming that a lot of the things that we were seeing weren't related to star formation at all. And what I'm saying is that the densities we're picking up, 50% of the objects are related, have things inside them, and the other 50% look like they're on the way. Of course, they may not be, but then you just have to do things even quicker with the ones that are. Okay? Or you have to believe that there's intermittency going on. So here's a nice...
What is the density?
The typical density of my cores are about 10 to the fifth.
Okay, does that give the turnover there in the efficiency?
So that's right about at the sort of the upper limit of what we can do with the HCN. But I point out there's no reason to believe, in fact, there's good reason to believe that the, you know, sort of the core density here is going to be different than the core density in other regions, because this is a much lower density. You know, the AV here is very low compared to the AV at which the typical star in the Milky Way forms, which suggests that the pressure here is much lower than the pressure at which the typical star in the Milky Way forms.
Because it's out of plane.
Well, just because these are sort of very, very small, low column density molecular clouds compared to the molecular mass in the Milky Way.
Yeah. The Gould's belt is not typical of the galaxy.
Most of the molecular mass in the Milky Way is in the giant molecular ring.
Right. So here's the plot where we're showing for Perseus. The hashed lines are showing where there is a which of the cores have protostars in them, and the solid is showing you the cores that don't have protostars in them. And this is to show you this concentration, as I said, is a measure of how peaked the source is. And so the more peaked the source, when the source is peaked, you definitely have protostars. And as you lose the peakedness, you don't have protostars in general inside these cores.
But can you disentangle how much of that is truly density increase and how much is just...
We've tried. We've tried. The thing is, you don't get a lot from the temperature, but you get a bit. And so we've tried to do that, but that's one of the concerns that we have, absolutely. The other one you can do is the total flux, and the flux is not as bad that way, because most of the flux is not right at the center of the object. Most of the flux is further out, and the flux that's further out, because most of the mass is not at the center, most of the mass is further out, and even if you have a protostar, you don't warm that envelope very much by the time you get out to 3,000, 5,000 AU. So in this case, you see that, again, the ones that are the brightest, the ones that have the most flux, are the ones that have protostars. Then you have these guys down here. And I do wonder whether some of this is getting late in the game for class zeros. In other words, they may have started over here, but late in the game, you've basically gotten rid of a lot of the envelope. And that's why they've dropped down to this length, to this scale. And it would be fun to actually try to follow the evolution of a class zero source, for example, and see how what we should get that way. We haven't done that. Okay? And I'm remembering now. Yeah.
But when you continue the game with Scuba 2, you will find even the structure of the cloud, and you could always call those cores or something.
Well, I don't know. I don't think so, because I think if we get to the structure of the cloud, what you guys have told us in the past is that inside the cloud as a whole, on larger length scales, right? These things are fluffier. Right, because they have non-thermal motions inside them, and I think that's really what the discriminant's going to be. I think we're picking out here the objects that basically do have a Jeans length because they are thermal, and they can't get much more than a Jeans length because they go unstable and collapse. But if I really want to look at solar mass or fraction of a solar mass objects that are part of the cloud, they're going to be part of the fluffy structure in the cloud. I don't think they're going to look nice and small. So I think that's going to be that's where the discriminant's going to be, and that's where you go back to that diagram and you're going to try to find out what's actually happening, how does it populate down below.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I agree, and that's one of the things I'd really like to get a handle on. And I think the simulations can help.
At some point, if you go fast enough, you will find a disagreement.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. In fact, I have often said that the JCMT in SCUBA was a lucky coincidence. They did not build the JCMT 15 meters so that it would basically just resolve a Jeans length in a nearby molecular cloud, and they did not make SCUBA so that it got down to 20 millijanskis or so that we would get basically objects down to a third of a solar mass or so. They didn't do it that way, but it just so happened that was almost the best way to start, because you could pick up objects you could look at without worrying about all of this other stuff. And now we're going to have to start doing that. That's right. If you do it in Ophiuchus, you get a slightly different answer, and this reminds me why that plot was different that we were looking at in Ophiuchus. In Ophiuchus, it is a smaller number. It's not 50% protostars and 50% cores. It's more like 30% or 20% protostars and 80% cores, so there aren't as many protostars. It wasn't the 50-50. And you can see that in here. Here are the ones that have protostars versus the ones that don't. This is the well-known, like the class zero problem that they have in Ophiuchus. The problem is we have class one sources, we don't have class zero sources, but then we have the cores again. Although the cores are somewhat different, they peak differently in Ophiuchus and in Perseus. But nevertheless, there does seem to be a difference, and trying to understand that, if that's an environmental effect itself, or whether it's an intermittency, or whether they're at a different stage of their evolution, is something we'd like to understand. So we're working right now, Jess Jorgensen, myself, Phil Myers, and Helen are working on a paper that's doing everything we did in Perseus in Ophiuchus, so that we can put that out and people can start to discuss what's going on. In the interest of time, well, I do want to show this plot really quickly. And this is to show that if we ask where our cores are, where the protostars are with respect to the core, we find them basically at the center. And again, we do have to worry a little bit about this brightening up of the center, but most of our objects don't look like they're very strangely structured. And if we look at where they are, we find that the protostars lie down within, you know, 5 to 10 arcseconds of the center of where we would say the center of our core is. And if you just ask how long it should take for them to move 10 arcseconds at the sound speed, if the core and the star that was forming were moving independently, it would take them, you know, something like 10 to the fifth years to move from the center out to about here. And the only argument we wanted to make with that was that if you believed that these things were competitively accreting and that they were moving at a very different rate to their core, then there's no reason why they should be peaked up at the center. We should have seen them all over the place, not just down at the center. And we don't see that. So there's every reason to believe that they really are related and moving sort of as one with their cores. The next step that we moved to is doing the kinematics of the cores. And there what we did is, this was work we did with Mario Tafalla in Madrid. And I want to point out that I visited Mario a few years ago, and he showed me beautiful, beautiful N2H plus results in Taurus. And they were so beautiful, I said, you know, this is incredible stuff. Before everybody else starts doing it, when you get the paper published, we should go and we should do this in Perseus and Ophiuchus. And we got the time to do Perseus because Philippe André had already gotten the Ophiuchus data. And we put out this summer a paper on Perseus. And unfortunately, in all of this time, Mario has been busy with things like annual reviews papers, which Chris understands how much time they can take up. And so the Taurus results aren't out yet. But we do have the Perseus. But the key point here is that it's Mario's idea, which he had done with Taurus, which led to all of this. And the point is that at IRAM, you can make beautiful N2H plus pointings, unfortunately only pointings, but they're only a couple of minutes is all you need to be able to get a nice strong N2H plus line that you can measure things off of, like measure their widths, measure their centroids and the like. And you get the C18O for free. And so in very little time, you can go and you can look at all of your interesting structure inside your cloud. And when we do that, here's where we looked. We did about...
N2H plus trace?
N2H plus is tracing the densest gas, right? So first of all, it has a high critical density, so you only pick up the dense gas, okay? Higher than 10 to the 4, let's say. And more importantly, what's really cool about it, this is where astrochemistry becomes very interesting, because that's also the same gas that the CO is frozen out in. There's no other place for those H plus ions to go. So they don't go to HCO plus, so they end up going to N2H plus, and it looks like the N2H plus gets boosted. So if you wanted to use this to try to get masses, it's probably dangerous because you don't know what your abundances are. But if you want to use this to try to look at the kinematics of these objects, we're using this as a cork. We're using this to try to understand what's going on with the structure inside the cloud. So we looked at, what, about 150 or so pointings. We actually did about 200 pointings, but we did a bunch of crosses on scuba cores to make sure that we weren't biasing ourselves by doing single measurements. And this is where we looked. And basically, we looked at every core we had. We looked at places from the Palomar plates that we hadn't looked very well at with the scuba map. And we looked at the two-mass extinction peaks, just to see if we could see anything. And our results were, virtually every scuba core we looked at, we found N2H plus in, surprise, surprise. About 50% of the Palomar plates, basically we think is that about 50% of them were getting dense enough, really getting dense enough, we were able to make the detections. And the two-mass peaks really aren't dense, they're just big objects, and so they have a large amount of column density. And the key point in doing all this, and in fact even the 14%, they're probably picking up a little bit of these other guys that are extended a little bit more than we thought. But the key point in all of that was that we can really trust that when we see an N2H plus detection, it's related to the core we're interested in. So what do? I stole this view graph from my student. Here we're looking, this is guiding the eye, and of course it may not be correct. Here's our core, here's our CO envelope. We see from the core we get a spectrum of N2H plus with all of its hyperfine. From around it we get the C18O. We get them at the same time because both instruments are used. And we can then go in, and if you just look at basically what these lines would look like, this is the different, this is what, if you took the N2H plus, the profile that went into making all the hyperfine, and what you get from the CO, and you can see immediately that in most of our cases the CO is broader, but as I'll show, the centroids are actually fairly similar. And that's why we argued that what we were seeing was the CO that we're looking at, the C18O, is really, we refer to it as an envelope because it did seem to be associated. If you go in and you just look at what the numbers are, we're now looking, here are cumulative fractions in terms of how much non-thermal we needed in terms of the sound speed. And we've separated them into the starless cores in Perseus and the stellar cores. And you see for the starless cores, they never really need anything more than, at most, they need to have the same amount of turbulent motion as they have thermal motion. But in general, they have significantly less turbulent motion than thermal motion. For this protostellar one, it's a little bit different, but of course, there's a lot more going on in those.
How high in mass do you, does the core?
Our cores are only going up to a few solar masses. We're not very massive cores at all.
And okay. The lowest mass is?
Maybe a third of a solar mass or so. Okay. And just one simulation, and I don't want to attack Ralph Klessen. First of all, he's not in the room, and second of all, he was one of the few people who was nice enough to actually give us something that we could compare with in one of his papers. But you see that in the turbulent simulations, one of the problems that tends to occur is that they have these more turbulent pieces, that there's fluff that has more shear in it. Now, the interesting thing is if we didn't try to associate that with a core, but with the CO, if you look at the CO envelopes, the CO envelopes are much broader. They do have much more extent to them. Okay? And in fact, you can do a reasonably good job of connecting to the CO. It's the N2H plus that's causing the problem, the densest stuff in the center, not the larger scale.
In Ralph's partial defense, and even if you take this into account, he just still doesn't get it. It still doesn't seem to completely work, but part of the issue for Ralph is that he's not doing in any of these sort of chemical modeling, and so
yes, and in fact that may play a role in some of this, because the ones that are higher velocity, they may not stick around long enough for the N2H plus to even differentiate.
Well, yeah. Even leaving that aside, he gets better, not complete agreement, but he gets better if you were to take his data and do a better job of the radiative transfer, he would get closer.
So this is the plot I wanted to show you about the CH2O and the N2H plus of similar centroids. What fascinated us, actually, because I wasn't expecting it, the cores are only making up a small fraction of the mass of the zone in which they're living. And so when I look at the CH2O wasn't guaranteed to be peaking up around my object. And yet when I looked at it in the observations in each case, in almost all cases, the centroid of the CH2O and the centroid of the N2H plus are very, very similar. Even though the CH2O has a fairly broad line, the centroid of that line and the centroid of the N2H plus are very similar to within the sound speed in almost all cases. In fact, it really peaks up right at the same value. And all this is telling us is that when I'm looking in the zone, there is sort of a hierarchy that my core is here, and the C18O that I'm picking up is localized around that core and localized fairly uniformly around that core in velocity space, or else I would see these lines being more separated in terms of where their centroids are. And so this is fascinating, and I'll bring it up one more time in the talk to say that I'm not going to show you the theoretical stuff because I don't want to show Shantanu's work, and we're still working on the paper, but I will tell you that we have trouble fitting this to any of the simulations that we're looking at. This is where we run into trouble, is that in the simulations, when we put in enough turbulence in the simulations to match large-scale structure, what we find is when we look along lines of sight, the N2H plus does not, the core velocity does not peak up with the bulk velocity that we get along the object in the simulations we're looking at.
Are those hydrodynamic or MHD?
They're hydro and MHD, but they are two-dimensional, which may be causing a problem. And they're also not driven, and they're also periodic boundary conditions. So all of these things may be causing some of the problems, absolutely. But that is what we're finding.
But in terms of, so what do you describe the shift between the N2H plus and the CO in the simulations? Why are they offset?
If you look at them, it's because there's lots of structure going on, and the N2H plus is not, the core is not staying in one location as at the same location as the lower density gas. They're separating out from one another. That's what I mean. That's what we're describing it to.
Do you have self-gravity?
Yes, they have self-gravity in them. Yes, and ambipolar diffusion.
No, but why is it moving then?
Because when you have a very turbulent flow, in which he has the very turbulent flows, then when I form an object, that object doesn't have to stay. The turbulent flow keeps doing what it wants to do, and this guy becomes like a little ball bearing, and it separates out. Right? It doesn't have to stay there, right? These are the same type of thing. If you have a nozzle coming down, forming a little object, if that nozzle moves, the object doesn't have to move in the same way. This is going right back to our earlier point.
Right, but your CO, well, at least your picture you drew, the CO envelope is not that much bigger than the N2H plus core. So if you had the ball bearing, if the N2H plus was tiny and I had this giant core, then it would be surprising if they were
Or if this core, if there is a dynamics, which these turbulent calculations are very dynamic, if that dynamics is being set up from a larger scale down to the smaller scale, if it's the larger scale that's setting everything up, then I don't have to be at the same
place. But like, I'm sure that part of the discrepancy is that your line width of the C of your C in this simulation is also larger than the observations. That's part of the reason.
Well, let me get to that. So let me jump forward to that information, because that's the last thing. That's the last bit. I'll skip that one and go. So I wanted to say that what we're trying to do right now is and this is what I would love to hear input from people. Okay, is what we're trying to do right now for the sort of the next part of Helen's thesis is we're trying to actually come up with some diagnostics to give back to the people who are doing simulations and doing theory. So we now, I've sort of walked you through, and one plot I didn't show was this one here. This is a beautiful 13CO map that was taken with FCRAO with 140,000 individual spectra. We also are going to be getting stuff like this with HARP already on the telescope at the JCMT, which is a 16-element heterodyne array. And we're going to be mapping lots and lots of molecular clouds, getting the whole cloud and being able to do the kinematics of the whole cloud for the CO. So we now have, what I think we have is, we now have the ability kinematically, dynamically, to start looking at star formation within the molecular cloud as a whole, and my hope is that we can find some nice measures that we can use as a comparison. Okay? So if we think that we have a cloud, the cloud has turbulence in it, there are these zones inside it that may or may not have less turbulence or whatever, all the way down to the cores, which we know are reasonably quiescent from the N2H+. So what we've tried to do is come up with three measures at the moment, maybe four or five, but I just wanted to show you what we're getting in terms of where they lie and why these are the ones I'm using. And if there are theorists or simulators who think that we should be using other measures, let me know. First thing I'm going to say is that I think that the right thing to do is to give you these measures in observational units, because that's what I can get. I think it's really a bad idea for me to try to give you virial numbers, because I have to make a lot of guesses to get to that. So I think it's... I think it's better for the theorists. Well, I can give you what I roughly think they would be. That's right. But I think it's better for the theorists or the simulators to take their boxes where they know these things, but observe them like they would do an observation and give me out the observational quantity. So what the first thing we've done is, we in Perseus, we were able to break the 100 objects or so that we found into about 8 different zones, NGC 1333, B1, etc. Those zones within the extinction map looked uniform enough that we fit those zones basically with Gaussians from the extinction map and said, okay, this is the region in the cloud where this thing is forming. This is the region that this is forming. We go and take those regions, so that might be one of these guys, for example. We go and we then look in the 13CO map and we measure the velocity dispersion of the entire 13CO over this zone. And that's what I'm putting here. And everything I'm giving you is into units of the sound speed, where we're taking the sound to be, we're taking the temperature to be about 15 Kelvin. Okay? So you can rearrange that a bit, but we're doing it that way.
In
H2? In H2, yeah. And so these are the different zones. This is NGC 1333, which therefore we're arguing would require a Mach number of something like 5.5 or so. Okay? And so that's what we've got along the x-axis here. And I think all my plots, that's what I'm going to use along that axis. That's the velocity dispersion of the region from the extinction map.
So that's the full width of maximum? On the number, I would guess.
But I think it's the full width half maximum. I have to go back and remember whether or not we were using sigma or full width half max. Okay? And now, the other thing I could do, the variety, what I was doing is, in these zones, I can look... We have pointed measurements towards each of the cores, and I can take the C18O along that direction, and I call that just my line of sight dispersion through the cloud, and that's what each of these symbols are. Okay? And the dotted line would be if the along the line of sight was equal to what I got when I did the whole region.
But why do you take
C18O and the 13CO? I had those measurements. I also do it in 13CO, but the C18O is along the particular lines of sight to the individual cores. Okay, I do it in the 13CO, and these are the solid lines. They're showing what you get, the extent that I get from, you know, top to bottom of along all the different lines of sight. Okay, and so you can see that along the lines of sight, individual lines of sight always lie below what you get when you take the bulk, which is sort of what you expect, right? It means that they're structured on large scales, right? No, but the point is you can do this. right? And the interesting thing is that the cores, if anything, lie at the bottom end of that, and that's probably because you're picking up the core, what's around the core, and so you're picking up localized material that doesn't have quite the same dispersion.
Right. The C18O, you're using the 2-to-1 line, right?
Yes.
Right, and so that's actually got a fairly high critical density. I mean, it's not. It has a higher critical density, certainly, than the 1-to-0. So you'd expect that you might be picking up.
You might be more, but also, more importantly than that, you're also looking towards something.
Sure.
Where you expect that there is localized structure because you're looking towards a core. So you already are looking at a... That was the whole reason we did that, was we realized we were looking along very specialized lines of sight.
If you were to look off the core in that same C18O 2-to-1 line, would you expect to see much of anything? I'm just wondering if you have any material that will emit that line.
Oh, yeah. Because these are dense zones that I'm looking through. I'm not looking through this part of the cloud, which is down at a few hundred or so to a few thousand. These regions still, we believe the mean density in these regions is still something like 10 to the 4.
Okay,
we're not talking about, yeah.
But before we move on, sorry.
Yeah.
The larger region, so the x-axis, is also done in C18O.
No, the larger region was done in 13CO, and so are these lines that we've put on the plot.
These are all Gaussian fits.
These are all Gaussian fits. That's right, because that's the best way to be able to run through a whole set of data. It's a good question as to what type of fit you want to do. But yeah, in this case, we've just done Gaussian fitting. That's right. Yeah. So the next thing I can do is I can tell you what the velocity dispersion of the cores are. And, you know, we already know this, that they are a bit more than thermal, but not dominated by non-thermal. This is the line width in the individual cores, and here's where they lie. The only one that has anything weird going on is in NGC 1333, and I would actually say that's probably a problem that we have with all the crowding in 1333 and actually getting good N2H plus measures. Okay? But the point is that they all lie down here. And what I want to tell you is when we've been looking at these with respect to the simulations that we've got, the 2D simulations, both of these are easy to fit. When you try to fit the structure, you get this type of a thing. It basically lives all the way along in this region, okay, when you do your different lines of sight. And when you look at the cores, most people's cores now get the cores to be nice reasonably quiescent, okay, especially when Shantanu puts in magnetic fields and the like, because the magnetic field slows the process down at that scale. The one that is hard to get is the difference between the core velocity and the line of sight velocity. Okay, so I'm now calling it line of sight as opposed to envelope because in the simulations we don't seem, this is that whole point, in the simulations that we're looking at, the C18O does not seem to trace the same velocity structure as the N2H plus does. In the observations it seemed to be roughly the same, only broader, with the same sort of centroid. In the simulations, when we actually look at the simulations, they seem to be all over the map.
You mean, in other words, this is N2H plus velocity versus...
This is N2H plus velocity centroid. So what I think the motion of the N2H plus is to the C18O velocity centroid.
So okay? C18O is not in your simulations. It's not producing a whole kind of...
It's not. It does pick up material around it, but it's picking up too much. And it depends on what's going on. It's either picking up stuff elsewhere that's causing us problems, or the stuff that's localized is not staying at the same, it's too dynamic, and so the stuff coming in is not coming in the same now as it did a few minutes ago when the material that actually made the core was formed. And in fact, that's similar to why my understanding was why Ian and that and Matthew started talking about some of this competitive accretion, was that their cores did not, the cores that they were forming and the material around it were not necessarily staying in the same places. And so then you have things running around and you have to go. And this is just saying that that's what we were finding in the simulation.
Right.
And the problem was, we had no problem if you didn't put any turbulence in the simulation, but then you are over here. And I'm saying that by the time we put enough turbulence in the simulation to be over here when we looked at it, we also found that the objects didn't want to stay.
Is that a simulation or the observation?
No, these are the observations, but I'm talking about in the simulations.
Of 1 kilometer per second sometimes.
What's that?
There are differences of 1 kilometer per second.
Sometimes. No, this is the core to line of sight motion in units of the sound speed. And the
sound speed
in units of the sound speed.
Did you include the free sound of the C18O in your simulations?
We did both. We took the free, because we did freeze it out, and then I said, oh, well, maybe that's part of the problem. And in fact, the other thing we've done in the paper, which is the first draft has gone to Shantanu, so I'm hoping that we'll have something we can publish by around Christmas time, maybe a little bit later. But I was initially worried that maybe this was a problem, you know, where we're putting thresholds. And so we played with a variety of things about what would happen if we changed our thresholding, or what if we just said there was no freeze out of the C18O, and that didn't change it. There's just not enough C18O. There's not enough material connected to the core along the line of sight.
Another possibility is that I think is worth mentioning. In your simulations, the turbulence is always decaying.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference.
Yeah. No, there are a variety of things that could be. It could even be two dimensions versus three dimensions causes problems too. So I'm not trying to say, what I'm trying to do, my goal here was really, and what I'm really keen to hear is whether or not these are the type of measures that people think will have some ability. The whole reason we started working with Shantanu's data was that although it's only 2D, he has magnetic field and turbulence and bipolar diffusion, and so you can try to watch what happens when you start with different conditions, and we can try to map out what the space looks like. The problem is we can only do it in 2D, but at least we could try to map out and see whether or not there were trends that were coming along.
Do you know what the density is if you're only doing a 2D simulation?
His simulations are they have a scale height, right? And so the there's a pressure.
So it's basically assuming that everything has the scale height set by the thermal sound speed.
That's right.
Yeah, but it seems to me that when you're trying to use density in things, you basically have a constant, you're setting something constant in the third direction, that's going to completely screw up your densities. The 3D, you might get column densities right, but you're not going to get densities right.
But we're looking at, well, they change. His height changes with, like, the denser regions are smaller in terms of their scale height than the low density regions, right?
Yeah, but he doesn't have the. It sounds.
No, there are problems. We've got the scaling that we're using, but I don't trust the. I'm not trying to be the simulator. I'm just trying to see whether or not we can use the simulation. What I was hoping was that the simulations would be guiding us, that we could say, oh, look, we can't do it with just turbulence. We can't do it with just magnetic field. We can do it in this type of a ballpark. Chances are this is the wrong ballpark because we're only doing 2D. But the idea was, can it give us some, basically, what you'd really like is some constraining power, because I don't think that the IMF and the star formation efficiency is enough constraining power to tell us what's going on in star formation.
Well, what is the green cloud? Because the green cloud does not behave like volumes. You have a very good agreement.
The green cloud is. I'll have to go and look at which one is the green cloud.
That cloud does not behave like most neurons.
It does look like that region is different. It may just not have enough of a sample, though, if it only has a couple of objects inside it. I'll have to go back and look at which one's which. No, I don't think they're all. I don't think there's a whole bunch of objects all at the one place in there. I'll have to go and look at why she's left the other ones out. Go ahead.
Okay, so in sometimes simulations, you don't look in the z direction.
No, we can't, because there's no motion that way. So we're doing one. We're actually observing the thing as a one-dimensional line. You're absolutely right. That's all we've got. That's right. Yeah. Yes.
I'm still not sure what I'm supposed to take from the y-axis in this plot.
What the y-axis telling you is that. So this is. Look at this thing here. Imagine that the blue. This is what we had thought from the observations, was that when I looked in C18O, I saw broader lines, but I saw similar centroid, meaning that they're of a sort of order of the sound speed, the centroids. And so what we assumed we were seeing was an envelope. We assumed that when I looked at N2H+, I saw the densest. I look at C18O, I see the stuff that's surrounding it. And even though it's broader, to first order, I expect it to be sort of equal on both sides, and this is what I'm getting. And what I'm saying is that we're having problems. So that's what this tells you. And the fact that they all lie down here says that from the observational perspective, the N2H plus and the C18O seem to be connected to one another. Okay? When we do it. When we've been trying to do, and maybe we've done something wrong, but when we've been trying to do this with the simulations that we have in hand, what we find is that that's not the case. That in the simulations, you wouldn't have made that same assumption. The spectra, the C18O, our C18O spectra from the simulations don't look anything like they look from our observations. And that's where we're having the problem. Along a single line of sight, we're having a problem. These specialized lines of sight through the cores, in particular, we're having this problem. So it's a good question. It's just something that we need to, you know, maybe that makes it a discriminant, which would be nice. So anyways, you don't need this because you're all theorists. You already know what it is we're trying to get. And I will just stop by going back to the point that my key point is that the observational surveys are giving us all this type of information. And really where the discussion needs to go is, back and forth, is to make sure that we understand what's there, understand what we can trust and what we can't trust. So it's being good to discuss it here. And then also, what are discriminating measures that we can take and use to go back and forth? And I think that that's what we need to be thinking about, because you now have enough that discriminates on what your large-scale structure in your simulations has to be and your small-scale structure. And it's not just the large-scale structure you put in at the beginning. It's the large-scale structure that you also have when you end, because when we observe, we're observing star formation has already been taking place, and we still know what things look like on large scales in those same clouds. So that's when we want to do the test and say, do you have the large scale and the small scale correct? And there's a lot more information in terms of time scales and what's happening inside the cloud. Anyways, I'll stop there. Hopefully I did okay.
So, any more questions?
Well, you left out the cloud of core velocity as a function of something else.
Oh, one plot. Are you talking about this plot? That's the only, what do you mean by left out?
Well, I mean, you are asking what should one get.
Oh, yeah, okay. So this I think is what you, this is in some sense I think what you're wanting, and I left it out because this is a plot from our paper that Helen and I put together on the N2H plus measures that we got in Perseus. And the one thing I would do differently now is that we used a virial measure, which I don't trust because I had to do a lot of assumptions and I wouldn't use it anymore. I used the CO line width for the region instead. But what we did here was we said each of our zones, we've got something like 8 or 9 cores. So I can take, not the one thing that I haven't done in those plots is I can take the 8 or 9 cores and I can measure their velocity dispersion. What is the velocity dispersion of those 8 or 9 cores? And I can compare it. Here I tried to compare it to what I thought was a virial measure. But I don't, as I said, don't trust that virial measure because I can't trust it to factors of 2. And what you're trying to do is see whether or not you're a factor of 2 below or a factor of 2 above the virial measure. But what I would do now is, and what Helen's actually trying to do some plots for us now, is do this conversion and say, let's take the CO line width, let's see where these cores lie within the CO line width of the whole region. And so that's the last one that I think, is that what you're referring to? Yeah, and I think that's a very useful measure, but it's something that we're only getting to now. That's right. Yeah?
It's clear that the observations are going to generate so much data. We're already generating data.
Exactly.
Lots of measures. And what isn't so clear maybe is, what is the minimum set that we have to think about to really nail down some of the physics, right? It would be hard to... You can try to quantify the morphology, how filamentary is it? Would that be very useful?
I agree.
What I'm trying to say is that's an amazing list. But what two or three things in there would be absolutely crucial to nailing a good
So that's where I think we need to have the debate, because I think that there was a hope at one point that the IMF was going to be enough, right? And everybody thought that if they could get the IMF, they would have solved star formation. Now everybody gets the IMF. So clearly that wasn't the constraint that we needed, right?
But that's a good start, because it shows that the turbulent stuff is on the right track. So you already tick off one box as a physical process that seems to account for that. But now what's next? You know what I mean? But that's a distinct step.
Well, I'm not sure. Have we actually shown that the turbulent simulations give me the core mass function as a function of time correctly? In other words, what I normally see is what they get at the end, but I haven't seen a lot of people do these simulations and give me time cuts and show me that as a function of time, we keep a core mass function that also looks like an IMF.
What I mean more is that in principle, the core mass function can be related to what the turbulent simulations are producing. Maybe the answer won't...
Right.
You know, maybe we'll learn something, but I mean, that turns out to be a very valuable thing to do.
Right, right. So
what would be... Next.
Well, the point is, I don't know. I'd love to hear the answer. For me, I came to the conclusion that, people put stuff in, and they run their simulations, and we believe that we understand some of the large-scale stuff as cascades or whatever of energies through different levels. We believe that we understand that we form cores because they become, you get down to a scale where you're a thermal scale, et cetera, and that gives us a gene's length of it, as you said. But the thing that I was looking at is that when I look at the simulations, my brain always looks at, watches these things saying, they look dynamic or they don't look dynamic. So the kinematics is the place that I wanted to start to play because I thought it might have that leverage. So that's my hope, but I don't know.
A distribution function that really captures the dynamics on the core scale or the larger scale? I guess you're arguing for the core scale. That's what the second part.
Well, I think, when I'm arguing for the core scale, but I would really like to see these simulations show me that they really do capture the large scale. And I'm, again, that's not something that I usually see, and maybe that's because it's a no-brainer and everybody knows it does, but when I see the simulations today, they talk about getting IMS, they talk about getting cores, but they don't say when they stop the simulation, look, I still have a Larson-like law on large scales.
Well, you know, one thing about the simulation is that you see the velocity fields, you often see flows, you know, the formation of the filaments, you see flows towards it, you see strong flows along filaments towards the cores. And I don't get that impression looking at the observational data, because there it's always just line lengths at some scale. And
well, unfortunately, I don't see things in the plane of the sky. So I have a problem with... No.
That's
so,
what I'm trying to say.
That's right. So I don't have that measure for you. I can't, you know, I can't rotate and see what these things would look like,
well,
right?
But the filaments are not exactly in the plane of the sky.
Okay.
You see a gradient along the
plane. No, but it's critical, if you're going to do that comparison, to do it with, like, the... some at least vague attempt at including the molecular excitation, the radiative transfer, because, you know, otherwise you're just fooling yourself. A lot of that stuff, you know, you're never going to see an N2H+, because N2H+ is only going to tell you about dense gas.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you actually, you know, I think Doug is exactly right. You need to take the simulation, and then you need to go through a second stage of post-processing it to figure out...
But you cannot do the N2H+ in post-processing. You have to do it dynamically. At that level, the chemistry cannot be done. You need to do the chemistry correctly. You cannot just do post-process.
You can do, I mean, it's certainly better than nothing. You can try to...
No, and
doing it in the simulation, I mean, do we really understand, you know, do we understand the chemistry of N2H+ well enough that you actually want to, like, put in a chemodynamical model and believe the output? I mean,
well, no, but...
believe that more
than
the post-process?
Right. But this gets back to it. So what good constraints do we have? Well, we don't have to worry too much about things. So we do know what we're trying to get out in cores. So I would say that there's a lot of structure inside these things that, boy, I'd love to be able to look at, but I don't know that we can get at it yet. But I do know a number of things that I can get at, and if we find that those aren't, if we find that those don't constrain us enough, we may be in real trouble, or we'll really have to look for more deeper things. But I don't actually think yet that we're really forcing ourselves to be constrained properly. And that's what I would like to see. But I agree with you. My whole thing is that I look at this as, you know, Scuba 2's coming online, and what we've looked at was about 5 square degrees, and we didn't do it very deep because it takes too long to map. Scuba 2 is supposed to look at something like a few hundred square degrees of Gould's belt to 3 times to 10 times fainter than our best maps, the ones we did in Orion and that.
So when is this going to happen?
Well, Scuba 2 now is supposed to reach the telescope before January, okay, over the Christmas holidays. And it doesn't have all the detectors yet. That's the biggest thing, is that the detector technology has proved difficult. But once it gets there, it's only about 2 years to do the survey. So that's 2 years of real time because it's part of other surveys, but it doesn't take very long. The instrument's between 100 and 1,000 times faster than Scuba. So the point is that it's not tomorrow, but within the next 2 to 3 years, all of this data will be available. What I looked at was I had two choices in life. I can either turn myself into somebody who's going to play with, you know, do all this data processing and like, or I could start thinking about what to try to get out of the data now so that I'm not dealing with that type of work. And so I agree with you. What I don't want to do is be overwhelmed with too much data. So we need, I think this is the discussion. This is why I accepted to come down here, was I wanted to have the discussion of what are the things that are useful to pull out of the data. To try to, and but this, it comes from you guys as well, because what are the things that you think makes your simulations better than Mark's or better than Ralph's? And what is different in your two simulations that we actually have a handle of trying to measure.
I think the kinematics is extremely valuable because it's proof, you know, because a lot of the debates are on sort of the large-scale dynamics. That is, are things in global collapse or not? Are things, you know, being held up by magnetic fields or not, and to what extent?
Right. So modulo the fact that you, as you already pointed out, that when we do the kinematics, because we're dealing with a tracer, which is a gas tracer, we either have to choose our tracer very wisely so we don't have to both do a lot of post-processing and a lot of during the run worrying about our species. So you don't want to choose some species that's coming and going and we don't know what to do with it. Given that, what would you do? So I like the N2H plus and the cores because I believe the cores are long enough lived that I get them, and I'm not trying to use it as a how bright they are. I'm just trying to use it as, is it a measure of my local vicinity?
But of course, Scuba 2 is not
going to
give you any of that information.
Scuba 2 isn't. No, to do the N2H+, we have to go to IRAM, and we have to get them to give us a large project, which I know that Edith thinks are a really bad idea nobody should ever get, but we have to convince Edith. Oh, okay.
That's
one measure.
Every tracer has its problem. I mean, the N2H plus, you worry about the, you know, the chemistry of the excitation, but it's nice in that observationally, the abundance of the N2H plus, at least once it's there, seems not to be varying wildly with density.
Well, for me, the thing was the fact that it's only there on my dense cores, and I got almost all of my dense cores, so I wasn't particularly worried.
Right.
Because it wasn't like I was finding dense things that didn't have it on large, and it wasn't like I was finding a lot of it when it wasn't. So I could use it. All I wanted it was a cork tracer.
How does N2H plus strength correlate with what you get from the dust? Is it tracing?
It traces very nicely what I get from the dust.
Cases, you don't see.
And we got it in all but I think two of our sources.
But then some of them, N2H plus is weak, just barely detected even though the dust is strong.
I didn't have too much trouble with that. No, I didn't have too much trouble with that.
There's a very nice paper by Tafai et al., a couple of papers, where they look at, you know, they take a couple of cores and observe them to death in, you know, 15 different tracers or something, and look at it with the dust, and try and actually make models for, you know, at what density things freeze out, what the abundances are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's only two sources, and you can say, oh, that it's typical. But at least it gives you some idea of how this would
behave. All the various lines are in those two sources. But
yeah, I mean, yes, you can worry how typical they are, but it at least gives you some handle on what things do, which is...
We got a student question.
Okay, I have a student question. So, in my simulations of primordial star formation, you know, we have a hell of a time with 12 species getting chemistry extraordinarily accurate. I mean, how many species do you usually follow in galactic star formation?
So we can do it very well. Because you all know that instead of dividing by 12, we only have to divide by 0. And so we get infinite accuracy on that species.
To answer your question, I thought that perhaps the next step would be to make numerical simulations with some realistic equations of stars. Well, which will rely on carbon abundances and ionization, and start in the
very beginning.
Yes, I know, but that to me is one of the major progresses.
It nail down the kinematics accuracy of each species in your view. Is that what you would achieve?
Start from the WNM and see how the CNM forms and condenses and the cooling goes on.
Why do you want to start? I mean, most of the H1 is already in CNM. Why would you want to worry about starting with pure W?
Because the velocity dispersion that it reminds me of all this controversy that people have had with HDNs for years. The fact that the velocity dispersion of the cold matter is the thermal velocity of the quantum medium. And in molecular clouds, it seems to me that we have the same, that is, the velocity dispersion of the cold gas is the thermal speed of the WNM.
My favorite analogy for this, or my favorite observation from this point, is M64. So there's some very nice data from Blissner-Rosolowski looking at the molecular clouds in M64.
M64
is the evil eye galaxy. It's in the local group. But the reason it's good to look at is because if you look in the center of M64, you're looking at a region that is 95 or more percent molecular. There's basically no atomic medium, and it's just because it's a higher column density. You know, the ISN is much denser than the Milky Way. The interesting thing is they see molecular clouds in M64, and to first order, they're exactly the same as the ones in the Milky Way. Now, obviously, this is a low-resolution observation. It's very coarse, but they have the same sort of line widths, the same sort of masses, the same sort of column densities. And, you know, to first order, they're exactly the same as the molecular clouds in the Milky Way.
But
and
it's a spiral?
It's a spiral galaxy. It's,
you know. And there is no H1 at all?
Not in the region where they've done the observations. If you go far enough out there, it's certainly.
So it's more like the center of our galaxy.
It looks sort of like the molecular ring.
Yeah.
But much more so.
The molecular ring is half the top.
Yeah, no. So it's like an extreme version of the molecular ring. But it's a spiral galaxy like the Milky Way. And it's just that, you know, it's the column density through the disk is, you know, in gas is a factor of 10 higher. And so it's all molecular and the molecular clouds look the same. And to me that says that, you know, however you want to explain the behavior of molecular clouds, it can't depend on the detailed chemistry of atomic, you know, or the detailed phase transitions of atomic phases and atomic versus molecular.
Well, that does not reply to my question. Because the molecular gas has to be embedded in something lower density,
And
you cannot stay molecular at very low pressure.
But if you look at M64, the entire ISM is at high pressure. So you see clouds, and there's an intercloud medium that they're embedded in. But
yes,
that intercloud medium is also molecular.
I have to think, but I've never heard of this galaxy.
Okay, it's Rosolowski and Blitz is the paper. Maybe Blitz and Rosolowski, I forget the order.
But how many years?
2006, 2007. It's very recent.
Okay.
More
questions? Okay, let's start.
Okay, well, anybody who'd like to join us for dinner. What's that?
Yeah, like sushi.
Sushi's fantastic. So we're going to go for sushi dinner.
7 o'clock, we're meeting at the sushi place.